Welcome back to IEF Continued Conversations. I'm Bettina Solinger, the head of the International Academy for Leadership of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation. And of course, I'm not alone, but joined by philosopher, facilitator, and may I say, driven promoter of liberal values and ideas, Sven Gerst.
Hi, Bettina.
Hi, Sven.
How are you these days?
I'm not really sure, to be honest, after what happened last week around the world, but maybe our guest today can help me clear the fog and tune down anxiety or strengthen my optimism. Let's see.
Okay, then as usual, I won't introduce our guest formally. I leave this to our guest himself, but let me say one word before I hand over to Thomas. And that is that his book, The World Still Needs the West, is one of the books that has great influence on our seminar programs. I run myself a seminar on geopolitics, and there we usually have a little debate club. We call it the Fight Club, whether this hypothesis is still true, whether the world still needs the West. And I must say, we get a couple of different responses, and for liberals, quite heated debates. So I'm very curious for this conversation today. And without further ado, I hand over to you, Thomas. Maybe you say a couple of words about yourself, how you would describe yourself to our listeners.
Yeah, Sven, I would like to listen into these conversations from the back without being known here. This is Thomas Kleiner-Brockhoff, director of the German Council on Foreign Relations, with a checkered past in public administration with the German president, in journalism and in think tanking, on two continents, in Europe and in the United States.
And you're based right now in the United States, if I understand correctly, right?
Yes, calling in from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Okay, that is indeed a wonderful place. Let's start right with your book, because I mentioned it already. It has a somewhat provocative title, although I think a couple of decades ago it wouldn't be as provocative as it might be now. The world still needs the West, and already there is a contested term in there, namely the West. And that's something that we will unfold throughout this conversation today. But let's first start with asking you the question, what was your motivation to write this pamphlet?
The doom and gloom. There is a constant drumbeat of analyses and claims according to which the West is toast, is over, is the last transatlantic president is just leaving the stage. So the claims to this end are endless, and I think they're based on a misunderstanding of the conception of what the West is, and that is the driver for this book.
Okay, then let's dig right into that, because I think there is a lot of conceptual ambiguity around the term the West. So in writing your book, what did you understand as the West? And again, in public discourse, there is a different understandings of the West out there, but I think you opt for a very specific notion of the West that is a bit more inclusive. So how would you define the West?
The West is not a location as in the West, but it is a concept, it's an open concept of international relations, of liberal thinking, and it is based on the notion of a rights-based culture, and especially of minority rights as the basis of liberal democracy. And where this thinking is at home, the West is at home. The West is just the geographic location of where this it came about. In a cluster of countries first, but it is by no means a geographic restriction, but it is an intellectual location of freedom where countries that cherish individual freedom find their home.
So, as I understand, it's more of a definition of, well, if a country associates themselves with liberal democratic values, they would be counting as the West. And that goes maybe against the public sentiment that the West is either like a locational thing of the Western Hemisphere, or whether it is something about economic advancements, or that, like some conceptions of the West would say, well, Western advanced societies, they are, or like advanced societies in general are counted as the West, or some people might even take a racial view that, you know, the West is always something that relates to white people. And I think we have this discourse, especially coming from the global South to a certain degree. But you opt for a value-based understanding of the West. But that raises the question, where is South Korea or Taiwan? Would they be part of the West? Because in a locational perspective, they wouldn't be part of the West. But as I understand, you would say these countries are part of the West, right?
The answer is clearly yes. And I think you're also completely correct in your your statement that there is different and have been traditionally different conceptions of the West. So the one is the advanced societies. There is an economic definition. There is even, as I said, a racist definition of the West. There's a cultural definition of the West. And so the political definition that I used, you called it the values-based, I call it the political definition as a political community with a set of political values, is actually the most recent one of those associated with the term West, which is why I can well understand that there is either confusion or in some quarters resistance to the term because of its differentiated and different historical meanings. But back to your question about whether South Korea or other countries in East Asia belong to the West. Well, first of all, that's a self-definition. Nobody will be forcefully entered into the club. I used to ask Japanese delegations in Berlin over many years, whether they thought of themselves as part of the West. And maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there was always a conspicuous silence when I asked that question, yeah, because people weren't prepared for this question. And I think now that has changed completely. When you get Japanese, they will ask you, what do you think we should do together now? So the self-assessment, and I think that may be a function of the Chinese hegemonial quest, has changed completely. And the self-association with the West has increased.
I just can add there that it is kind of a vibrant debate in East Asia. So I was in Korea earlier this year, and I asked a similar question to like delegations, the professors of international relations, advisors to the foreign ministry. And they had very mixed results. To a certain degree, they said, yeah, we are part of the West, but we see a weakness of the West, like in the Korean discourse. And I think that is something actually very Korean, that they say, well, the West would be better off if we would take leadership in the West. So that was the Korean perspective on the West, that the West is somewhat in crisis and we need more leadership. And that's why they hesitated, because, of course, I think from the Korean perspective, it needs to be a strong alliance. So that brings me to my question about maybe, again, the motivation of your book. Is the West in crisis that we see that books such as your book is needed? Or do you think there's just a temporary ambiguity that we have in scaling up the Western value-based alliance?
Well, both. yes, it is in crisis, or in crisis in its current incarnation. Because I would call it a mistake we tend to make is that we associate our current institutional setup, we equate that with the West. We think if there is no NATO, there is no West, or if there is no European Union. So think about the institutions that we've given them as eternal. And then if they are in crisis, the West is in crisis. No. Even if there was no NATO tomorrow, that wouldn't mean that the West doesn't exist. By the way, you see that with Brexit. Yes, it has left the European Union, but is it a European, is it a Western country? Oh, hell yes, it is. Don't think of the West as a static colossus. But we will see adaptation and change to its institutions. Now, that these institutions are challenged, that I think is without doubt. That they are challenged from within and that they are challenged from outside. And this combination creates, I think, the crisis that that we're in.
So, I mean, this book was written before President Biden came into power. So it was written after the first experience with Donald Trump. And maybe we all thought after he was elected out of office that this chapter is closed. He came back and it seems comes back with a vengeance, or how they say in English. And everybody is now stirred up. So it's high time to rethink how we want to shape the Western ideal or the Western idea of how we want to work together internationally, how we can thrive together, how we also define and challenge those who challenge the Western, the idea of the West, the enlightened, liberal democracy, rule-based cooperation, strong institutions that we thought we had, but that are now challenged a lot more than before, it seems. Is it too late? I mean, this is the doom question, but where should we start to pull everything into the other direction again? Because we see the populist upswing everywhere, and they are not interested in what the liberal idea has been up to now.
Bettina, it's never too late as long as there is the human desire for freedom. There is no time and no necessity to despair on anything. So, yes, I would have, as your intro said, expected myself that the chapter of Donald Trump would have been closed in 2020. I had no expectation and that he would return in a 2.0, let's call it improved version. However, I did expect that some mutation of populism would come back, whether to power in the United States or in other countries. It was clear then, and as it is clear now, that the causes for the populist revolution, let's call it that, are still unaddressed. And as long as these causes that lay at the heart of domestic policies, mostly of liberal societies, not solely, but largely, there will be the desire for populist solutions, or in this case, far right populist solutions. What I found so interesting is in the post-election analyses in the United States, there were the exit polls and the were analyzed, and the exit polls showed that next to the economy, democracy was the most important topic that people voted on. That initially gave Democrats hope because they believed, oh, if it's democracy, it'll be a vote for us. Turns out in these post-election analyses that half the people that voted on the grounds of democracy actually voted for Donald Trump. And they feel in their self-conception, democracy is threatened by those who claim themselves to be the guardians of liberal democracy. Now, of course, their conception of democracy is different. It's a majoritarian democracy in which not a liberal democracy in which the core is the is the protection of individual and minority rights as and the limitation of the power of the majority vis-a-vis the rights of those minorities. So what we have here is a claim to democracy by both sides, but on different grounds, and that is the fight of the future. Is not simply an authoritarian quest, but a quest of two conceptions of democracy. At least in self-conception, it is democracy because it can, as we see with the first moves even of Donald Trump, have a pretty rough and tumble approach with little regard to any opposition or the rights of minorities in the system, and certainly not to the institutions. If you go and tell the senators of your own party, please step aside because I want to make appointments and you're in the way, that doesn't bode well for the years ahead. And it does describe the fight about the heart and soul and the nature of democracy that we have ahead of us.
I think that's very much the internal struggle, right? So what I really enjoyed about your remarks in the beginning was like there's an internal struggle of the West and then there's the external challenge to the West. And the internal struggle is somehow that our own liberal democracy is under attack, right? And sometimes by our own false wording. Like in the past, when we talked about democracy, what we really meant is liberal democracy. And now a new system emerged with the populists. Viktor Orban calls this illiberal democracy. We have talked on this broadcast a couple of times already about that, right? The populist challenge is on democratic grounds. It's not like the typical authoritarian versus liberal democratic regime. It's like on the very same essence of democracy. One is a majoritarian illiberal democracy, and the other one is the core pillars of liberal democracy, where the rule of law and individual rights and minority rights are upheld. And that's the internal struggle. I feel that the West gets less and less acceptance in its own societies because liberal democracy that underpins your concept of the West somehow gets under attack by the populists. And so let me ask the action-directed question. What should we do? Like, not to fight the populists. I think we have done many of that, but like as the West, as a bloc, as a geopolitical entity, what are some of your thoughts and recommendations? How should the West get this problem solved, this internal challenge to itself?
Well, one element of an answer. Well, first of all, if I had the answer, and if I had the answer 8 years ago and would have been able to popularize this answer, Donald Trump wouldn't be back, but he is back because we don't have the answer. And so let's dabble in elements of answers. One that I think is very strong in people's minds these days is we have asked ourselves and have committed ourselves in our political dealings with input illegitimacy. To a very high degree. And we have a very sophisticated system of created input legitimacy. But we have forgotten about output legitimacy. Democracy has to deliver. With all the protections, from data protection to workers' rights protections to all kinds of protections, work time and technical and insurance, and we have built a system that is so sophisticated that we cannot deliver on the goods that we need to produce as a society anymore. So there is an output dilemma. Created by our desire for input legitimacy, where we, I think, have to find a new balance. The second element, and the American election shows this clearly, is that the especially blue-collar workers on both continents, and this is not restricted to the United States, sees a policy in front of them that they can no longer support because it doesn't seem to support them. The cost of living crisis here is just the front side of a problem that democracy is being seen as elitist. And if democracy is an elitist project that doesn't produce outcomes that are for me, then democracy has a problem. I could go on with a couple of more if you would like. For me, of course, identity politics was a big issue in this election, and the illiberal elements of identity politics have come to the fore, certainly in the American electorate. So I think there is a whole set of challenges that the American electorate has clearly voiced, so that the danger of Donald Trump to them was smaller than the danger of a Democratic Party that is at the core of these problems, or so the electorate thinks.
Yeah, I think it will be very interesting for you to hear that we just finished a seminar where we talked about the future of liberalism, and one of the key points that we made there is that liberalism needs to be deliberalism, you know, deliberalism. So it needs to deliver, right? The delivery argument of liberalism needs to be strengthened, because in the end we forgot, and I think I really share your analysis here, we forgot over the last couple of years that in the end we also need to deliver the goods that come out of this political system. And only then we will get what you call the output legitimacy, or the acceptance, like to put it in more colloquial words, the acceptance amongst the population. But now with a lot of things going astray in our societies, we have high level of polarization. I think you feel that in the United States is highly polarized, but we see levels of polarization all over the world. I think your call is mostly like, we as liberal Democrats need to get in our house in order, because so far we talked about domestic politics, but all of this has implications for international relations, right? If the West appears as this polarized block, or, you know, internally torn apart block, on a world stage with actors such as China or Russia will take advantage of that, and they're already doing so. Or am I too paranoid here? But I really feel that we are turning inside, and that makes it easier for emerging world powers such as China to gain more relevance on the international stage. And maybe just one last remark here. It reminds me a lot of the great financial crisis in 2008. The whole Belt and Road Initiative of China basically came about because the great financial crisis led the United States to retract, to look inwards. And because of that, to fix their own problems, we suddenly had another bloc emerging. And that bloc is, I wouldn't say like illiberal per se, but it's a different value system that is emerging. And that's something that we see. Do you share my thoughts on that particular thing?
First of all, I love the liberalism must be deliberalism. That is great. And yes, I do share your perspective, because there is a foreign policy side to the illiberal revolution, and we've seen that emerge over a significant period of time now. It has to do with the retreat from the world stage, especially of the United States, in parts of the global landscape. Middle East is pretty obvious.
Also Afghanistan, I think these pictures are very recent.
Yeah. Exactly. That's one thing. But there's also, I mean, let's take as an example the elections in the three Eastern German states just a little while ago. I think what we are seeing there is the rise of a movement that I would call anti-Zeitenwende. It is anti-integrationist. It is anti-European. It is anti-American, on the left and the right, by the way. It is isolationist. It is nationalist, and it has a deep root in German philosophy and German thinking, except that we haven't seen it in force in many decades, at least not to this extent. And clearly, this is partially another delivery problem. To the people who vote this way, the international system is not delivering what they want out of the international system to them. Now, I think for reasons that I can much less associate with than the domestic reasons, and the domestic reasons I can understand, I can see. Here, the reasons are often often a misconception about the role of the nation state and the ability of the nation state to solve problems, which is the take back control slogan that comes with the populist foreign policy.
You did go further back with the end of history and so on, so that especially in Europe, the countries thought, okay, everybody wants to be a member of the West and will develop into the West. And if they haven't picked up the values or are not adhering to the rules that have been established after historic disasters, that we just said, okay, they haven't grown in yet, and there will be time. And the West has been very patient and maybe also a bit arrogant to think that there is a determination towards expanding the idea of the West. And that made it also possible for other movements to gain momentum. So after all that, now when we look at the map now with the United States, but also some Eastern European countries, especially like Hungary and so on, will they still belong to the West if it goes on with their development into maybe an electoral autocracy or something similar? Should we just accept that and say, okay, but let's go on with our first idea and try to revive it and try to work on our institutions, maybe cut back also of our expectations a little bit, but move forward instead of now just complaining about others not sharing our ideas?
I mean, the West is clearly in a defensive position. You described the expansionary phase of the West, in which we sort of chuckled about Fukuyama's end of history, but we lived the end of history. We actually believed it, that this would be a sort of a systemic end of history. Therefore, we believed that countries, as you mentioned it, that weren't quite there would get there tomorrow. And we wouldn't have much to do because we would have just to administer the inevitable outcome of history. That was, you called it arrogance, and there is an element of arrogance to this.
Maybe complacency.
It turned into complacency. At first, it was sort of the arrogance of those who found themselves on the winning side and just needed to administer, and the others needed to become as smart as we already were. So that was the mixture of a teleological approach. There's only one end in this. This is preordained where we're going, and we don't have much to do. And that led to the complacency that you mentioned, because the outcomes are already set. Now, of course, we learned yet again that that wasn't the case, that those who didn't like the liberal system from the outset were looking for ways to either duck under it or hedge against it and increasingly look for a different system. and recently to oppose it, including militarily. So we're seeing an increase in not only opposition, but in hostile behavior. So while the West is shrinking because of its domestic problem, you mentioned it, at some point an illiberal democracy can well turn into a competitive authoritarian system. So while the West is challenged from the inside, it is also challenged from the outside that by countries that want a different world. And we're increasingly seeing this from a cooperative world based on the ideals of liberalism to a competitive world in which value base is a secondary or no consideration. In fact, some see that as the real enemy.
Well, before we look at external challenges, let's come back to the questions whether the US after Donald Trump 2.0, as you named him earlier, or the government, will it still be part of the West? Given that if we define the West as a base of values, will he leave?
I mean, Donald Trump is only the American president. Let me minimize his role a little bit for a second. He's not America. He's the American president. And yes, he's been voted into office by a plurality of Americans and an impressive electoral college majority. But there are other institutions. There is a federal system. When the governors of several states were asked whether they would, for the federal government, execute the planned mass deportations of irregular immigrants, they said, hell no. So we will see a big fight about this in the United States itself, and you will see the different power centers of a federal republic show themselves. So in that sense, Donald Trump is very influential, and sure enough, he has the levers of power in his hand with both houses of Congress, the immunity decision of a Supreme Court that he and his philosophy control. So there are already reduced checks and balances in the system, and he can, at least for the next 2 years, march ahead, and he will do so, and he is doing it right out of the gates as we see. But that doesn't mean, that he is, you know, controlling, or he will be in the next couple of years, be controlling all levers of power. Yes, we all know that re-election is the point at which populist leaders turn into less democratic, or the countries turn into a less democratic structures, and we're seeing democratic decline, and we will be seeing democratic decline in the United States. But does that qualify them to us to say that they are no longer part of the West? I would doubt that. Too much other things going on in this country, too deeply rooted democratic culture. I would still be optimistic about that. But democratic decline, yes. Trouble to rebuild it, especially with a vendetta in the judicial system that we will be seeing, oh, sure. This will be a long-term challenge of the United States domestically.
Well, but it still has implications for now to more the external world. So I want to shift the conversation to more towards foreign affairs and foreign relations. But we need to start with Trump, because if we look at the West, one transatlantic alliance, of course, plays a big role, and that is NATO. And if I hear some of the rhetoric from Donald Trump's side and from his camp, then we can't be so sure that we will see a flourishing NATO in the future. So before we turn towards BRICS and China and all the other challenges to the West, how do you see the international institutions, not only the UN and these international institutions, but particularly NATO, where we see a lot of rhetoric coming out of the Trump camp?
I mean, Donald Trump doesn't much care for international institutions. He doesn't much care.
Yeah, but that's the problem, right? That's the problem.
his appointment, or his nomination rather, of Elise Stefanik as ambassador to the United Nations speaks volumes here. We won't see much regard for any WTO rules in his his trade dealings and the tariff regime. He will likely leave the Paris Accords a second time. So I think we will see a diminution of the international system as such. And he has made very clear that he understands alliances to be a burden to America rather than a force multiplier, which, as America is in relative decline, Europe is in absolute decline, America is in relative decline, you would think the opposite would be true, that your main advantage over your competitors is your alliance system, that you would therefore have to strengthen as you are in relative decline. Donald Trump thinks differently, and he will try to force Europeans into submission in his foreign policy, and that comes in two different respects. One is NATO commitments, and the second is China. So institutions' secondary concern, if a concern at all.
I must say that he doesn't need to force Europeans into submission. I think there is something that Jeremy Shapiro called the self-fertilization of Europe. Like we basically put ourselves to a certain degree in high dependency on the United States, and that's the world we have to deal with now. And maybe just to close things off with NATO here, do you think a politician like Mark Rutte can do an impact here? I think he has a good relationship with Donald Trump. What's your best guess here?
I mean, the Europeans have to think who are the best emissaries, who are the people who can best deal with Donald Trump, and Rutte is certainly among them. One could think about Donald Tusk as his relationship with Poland. Now that was grounded on the association with the Polish populace, but maybe it also works with a liberal Democrat. And then, of course, there's Giorgia Meloni, but though that would be the triangle of Europeans with a lot of doubts on Meloni and where she actually would be going under these conditions. So, but there is a choice of European interlocutors, and it's likely not to be some of the traditional ones that we know. Yes, Mr. Macron would like to play the role that he thought he played in the first term, but he is a lame duck president, and his approach of flattering Donald Trump has failed in the first term. And the new German chancellor, first of all, we have to see who that is, and whether he is capable of doing that is also unclear at this moment.
Yeah,
His best friend in Europe seems to be Viktor Orbán.
That is true. Yes, I mean, what my concern is that while we talk ourselves into the claim that this is the hour of Europe, that Europe was forged in crisis, and given Donald Trump, Europe has to now stick together, and therefore it will, that this is a fantasy. We already see clubs emerging in Europe. We already see the bilateralization of the relationship. We already see a beauty contest. And I think I see at least three groups emerging in Europe. There are those with Emmanuel Macron who will resurrect the concept of European sovereignty, and some will go further and say European autonomy. There are those who, based on their security dependency, will fall into line or hedge or try to buy time. Those will be the Eastern Europeans, the Northern Europeans, and I would put Germany into that camp. And then there will be those led by Viktor Orban, who will see this as the moment when the dominoes fall, and the appeal of right-wing populism will reach Europe in a different way, and he thinks of himself as the leader of Europe, And he will find associates. He already has a left-wing version in Slovakia. Let's think more a little bit about Austria. There's Italy. I think there's enough candidates. Think about next year's France. I think there's candidates abound for Viktor Orban's vision of Europe. So we will see a split Europe, not a united Europe. And it will be easy for Trump to pick and choose, and we will be happy to do that. It was Joe Biden who knit Europe together half a year before the attack by Putin on Ukraine. He resurrected and built the Western alliance and was able to do that, and knowing that a united Europe is better for him. And that reminds us of the traditional American role as the pacifier of Europe. And the big difference is that Donald Trump is not that guy.
But what we have now done is to a certain degree what the Global South would criticize about the West. Like, we have been torn up in these internal discussions. And I think for the last couple of decades, we have been very occupied with ourselves, especially in Europe, but also the United States, due to increased polarization. Mm-hmm. And the first Trump term that put not speed bumps, but accelerated this whole movement. And Joe Biden couldn't be the speed bump that we all expected. Like, the polarization continued. And now let's talk a little bit about the external challenges, because if I look around the world, the West is not only domestically in decline or under threat, but there are external challenges. The Global South is voicing more and more its opinion about the international institution. BRICS has formed. We see emerging world power with China. It's often coined as the dragon bear, like a China-Russia alignment to a certain degree as an anti-Western alignment. And if I look at the Arab Barometer, for example, we see that the acceptance rates after the 7th of October for the West, in particular the US, has been in rapid decline. I mean, it's astonishing how the acceptance rates for the West, namely the US, has been collapsed at the expense of China, where certain countries or the population of certain countries favor a Chinese hegemony over an American hegemony. And that seems like something that should worry us. So what should we make out of these external threats? Are BRICS, the Global South, whatever it is called, a real threat to the West? And are their concerns legitimate? How should we react on an international sphere to that?
The BRICS have traditionally, since their inception, been underestimated by the West, based on the claim that they actually have nothing to do with each other, that this was a business consultant's idea based on growth, but not on anything else. Now the BRICS countries, in their original version, have shown us differently. They have institutionalized their dealings. There is a wide network of things accompanying every BRICS summit. There, for example, is a think tank network, just in my business, in those countries that accompanies these and evaluates and makes policy suggestions to the BRICS. So the BRICS have shown themselves to be more durable than we thought, and we were unable to imagine that the BRICS would actually have joint initiatives like a bank. Now their big goal is to not replace, but reduce the salience of the dollar as a trade currency. And again, at our own peril, we underestimate the potential of them actually succeeding in this. And the basis of all of this is that is an anti-Western and anti-American hegemonic tendency in these BRICS, which is strong enough to overcome the difference between the two democracies, South Africa and Brazil, in cahoots with the authoritarians. And this is something that we will never understand, is how the Brazilians can actually work with the Russians and the Chinese. I met with the Brazilian head of policy planning in a bit of a larger meeting, and he proclaimed the vision of a Brazil resurrecting the international order based on the charter of the United States, of the United Nations, together with the BRICS. And so I intervened and said, is this a joke or is this just a double standard? How in heavens can you attempt to resurrect the principles of the UN Charter together with Russia? What is your goal here? And so this is something where we don't understand ourselves. They claim for us to be the continent and the continents of double standards, while they don't see the basic double standard that the BRICS and this whole movement is grounded upon. So it seems to me that at our peril, we underestimate its potency, and we underestimate the driver of the anti-Western sentiment that is at the core of it.
So would you see a risk for that there will be a competitive international order?
What do we mean risk? We already are in an yes, in Germany, we talk about the multipolar order and think that's a good thing. The chancellor even mentions it in the foreword to the national security strategy in a positive context. Mm-hmm. The idea of multipolarity was, by the way, as a term invented by Sergei Lavrov when he was ambassador to the United Nations. Multipolarity, some people glorify, but multipolarity is a balancing system that, in my view, can only be a transitionary, can be of a transitionary nature, if at all, because it doesn't have power centers and it doesn't have hegemonic desires. It assumes that it has it doesn't have hegemonic desires, and it also assumes that there is an element of a rules-based system in a multipolarity. None of these two things are very likely to happen. So I think what we're seeing is an increasingly competitive order. And the competition clearly comes from authoritarian countries who are most openly challenging the hegemonic piece. And what we are also underestimating in our desire to defend the rules-based international order, that any rules-based international order also has a hegemonic element. Without a top dog within the group of those who cherish a rules-based order, there would be no order. So therefore, we, I think, have to accept that there is an hegemonic element combined with a rules-based approach in the United States pre-Donald Trump. Now, what is that? What does that mean with Donald Trump? I think it will be a much more a much tougher and much more not a systems conflict, but a hegemonic conflict, a pure hegemonic conflict that with Donald Trump we will see. But as Germans and as Europeans, we can't escape the fact that that multilateralism and even multipolarity, which are two very different concepts, are on the retreat, and that we're headed for or in the midst of a competitive order, and the wars that we're seeing in the Middle East and in Russia's attack on Ukraine are testament to both.
I think it shows that we are in kind of a world of turmoil and like systematic rebalancing by all of these wars breaking out and skirmishes breaking out, like even Nagorno-Karabakh, like that just shows that something is going on in the world where these skirmishes become more and more normalized. Now, on the other side, it seems to me that we are still far away from multipolarity. The United States still has all aspects of what we need for an hegemonic power, the strongest military in the world, the strongest economy in the world, technological leadership. But on the value basis that we can convince the rest of the world that these rules-based international affairs and the rules-based international order is something that we want to adhere to, we become more and more under threat. And you said something about hypocrisy, and I think that leads me to my next question. Like, has the West in the last couple of decades just become so too arrogant. Not so arrogant, but too arrogant. Because there's this famous quote, I forgot by which African leader, that it goes something like this. If you want to get development projects with the European Union, you get a lecture. And if you want development projects with China, you get the money. And that, I guess, shows us a little bit of the pickle that the West is in. We stand up for those values, but often we cannot live up to those values, especially not in a geopolitical world where interests also have to kick in. And the US has always been good at bolstering its interest in the world. So what do we make out of this? Do you share the assessment that we have become too arrogant? And maybe what is your recommendation in dealing with that? Because values is something that comes out of deliberation and convincing and persuasion. But I think we lack that part.
I think our conceptual of liberalism, especially in dealing in foreign affairs, has been too aggressive and has been too forward-leaning. We want to educate the world, and we want to change the world towards democracy, and we're using our instruments. Conditionality is an instrument of Western expansion. We want them to live by our standards, and our standards are based on our values. Those are societal, economic, environmental standards, ESG. And that's how these projects come together. This is how all of our development aid is constructed, so that others do as we do. The whole legislation that is surrounded supply chain management is based on such assumptions in Germany as well as on the European level. And that is an expansionary liberalism. My question is, we have enough things to do at home with defending liberalism against the illiberals. Why are we going out and searching for transformations of others? So it seems to me that a more moderate liberalism that shows the light of liberalism, and the light of liberalism is an exemplary, and we are very far from being exemplary, is the much better approach to finding new friends than forcing conditionalities of all sorts on them and preaching. There's a preachiness about liberalism. That is our problem. And we have no reason to be preachy. We also are not good exemplars. That is what creates our own hypocrisies. So if we were to have a more exemplary and moderate liberalism, we're much less in danger of being called out on our own hypocrisies.
What does this mean in the contemporary situation of the global community? Shall we then turn more inwards to ourselves and concentrate on how we do it, but not being missionary anymore, building up what you in your book called tempered liberalism? Or should we also then start giving up on values and become more interest-driven, just to not be left out of the game for the future, so to speak?
It would be a misunderstanding that probably I created if it was to be understood that I meant an inward turn. I don't mean an inward turn.
No, I mean beginning with ourselves instead of preaching it and
that's a different thing. You can still do an active foreign policy. Yeah. But it isn't the missionary zeal with which we have tried to expand democracy. And now there's a different thing between democracy promotion and democracy assistance. We've had that debate for a long time. And also the means by which you do it. I mean, we've had two versions of that. One version was the expansion of international law and the globalization of a legal regime spanning many, if not all, international spheres. That is sort of the left-leaning version of this expansionary liberalism. And then there was a right-leaning version that does that with bayonets. So if you don't follow, we will invade. And then there has been a more moderate, that's the democracy promotion world, that, by the way, illiberal or authoritarian societies have called the West out on for a long time and seen especially NGOs as part of the government sphere of these countries with their expansionary zeal. So it seems to me we need to rethink how we address other non-democratic countries with these instruments of our foreign policy and of our development policy, because they're increasingly playing a part in the perception of how these countries see us. They see us as intrusive and aggressive into their lives. That's not an inviting strategy. I mean, we may, with sort of the crisis that the West is in, may no longer be in the position to conduct such policy. If anything, power or the lack thereof can be a good educator here. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't have that you should have an isolationist or inward-looking foreign policy. You just have to think about the tools with which you approach these countries, and this will, in my view, reduce the hypocrisy problem that is an endemic problem in the global South as the perception of the West goes.
So if I sum up, then what you just said is like, okay, we need to get our own house in order, so to speak. Like, a liberal democracy is under attack, and if we want to live up on a foreign policy level to the values that we adhere to, we better get them right. Like, because, for example, if I take the United States as the world hegemon as an example, it is very hard to look right now to the US and say, oh, that's an exemplary society, right? It's highly polarized. They just elected Donald Trump. So how can we go into the world and say, oh, there's a problem with Erdogan, there's a problem with Modi or whatever it is, right? Because similar dynamics play out there. So we lost kind of the moral high ground, as a philosopher would say. And that's how I sum up some of your remarks here, right? Do I get that right?
Yes, you do. It's the moral high ground we've lost, and it is unlikely that we will regain it under the presidency of Donald Trump. Moral high ground and Donald Trump is a misnomer. So I think this is a long way off. But most of the issues that I mentioned to you, I think, are not in the daily discussion in our Western countries, that there is something that we should be looking to. This type of a more tempered liberalism is often seen and misunderstood to be a liberal retreat. No, it's a liberal resurrection, because it goes back to the foundations of what we are and who we are, and it's what this expansionary period is based on is something that we have never had in world history. That is a short moment of global liberal hegemony. We've never had that, and we don't have it now. We got to get used to the fact that we're not the majority, but we will have to defend the way we live and the values-based systems that we have, rather than preach everybody to become like us.
And liberals should actually understand that, because if there's one thing that liberals hate is to be lectured at. So in that sense, they should very much understand that sentiment in the world. So I will bring things to a close. And usually we ask our guests to give a little recommendation on a reading or book or something that you found interesting and that might be relevant to our readers to follow up on our conversation. Did something come to your mind, a recent book, besides, of course, your own, or a reading that you would recommend to our listeners?
Well, I'm telling you what I'm reading now, that's I find that to be interesting. Robin Niblett, the former head of Chatham House, wrote a book called The New Cold War: How the Contest Between the U.S. and China Will Shape Our Century. Now, he describes in this book why this is the former, this is the formative construction, the contest between the two. But what also the differences are, there's a whole set of differences why we shouldn't think of this contest to be similar or the same as the Cold War. So while the metaphor is still valid, there are differences. So this book differentiates between the idea of a new Cold War and the new phenomenon that we're that we're confronted with. The most important one, of course, being that the old Cold War was based on fragmented economies. Now we have integrated economies in a global sense that will make a Cold War, if you want to even use that term, look very different.
Okay. I certainly have that on my reading list. I already bought the book, so I will be diving into this book, and I recommend it to our listeners. We thank everybody, and of course you, especially Thomas, for joining us today. And for our listeners, make sure to like and subscribe, as they say. Subscribe to our podcast, new episodes coming up. And I think the term of geopolitics and the geopolitical world will stay with us for a long while, unfortunately. And of course, Donald Trump will stay with us. We didn't expect it, but here we go. Let's make the best out of it, because one thing that I can say is that this time we seem to be more prepared for it. Last time it caught us by utter surprise when he won against Hillary Clinton. This time, at least, we don't seem to be so surprised. So there is some hope for the West. And with those notes, I leave you. Thank you very much for dialing in.